We are Silver Screen, and we're here to make you think about death and get sad and stuff. One, two, three, four. I could not resist. Welcome back, film fanatics, to another exciting episode of the Silver Screen podcast. I am Mike, your regular host, or one of your regular hosts, here with the other host of this thing, DK. Hello.
Hello.
You excited for this one?
It's been a while since I watched it. I watched it when we were originally scheduled to record, and that kind of fell by the wayside. So, you know what my memory's like.
Fair enough. Well, okay, so presumably you're ready to dive into the cinematic world once again for a regular old Silver Screen. We've been doing a few cults and classics, but here we are again. So today we have a special treat as we're joined by a returning guest from our Godzilla vs. Kong review and I believe Rocky Horror. Please welcome back returning guest and fellow Edgar Wright superfan, Michael Whaley. Welcome.
Hey, everybody.
Thanks for jumping in on this one, buddy. I did say that off air, but thanks for jumping in and for your impeccable taste in movies, apparently.
So. Of course, yeah. I'm an Edgar Wright stan, so this is one of my favorites.
In this episode, we are setting our sight on a film that has captured the hearts of many, namably Scott Pilgrim versus the World. Directed, as we said, by Edgar Wright, this film blends comic book aesthetics, video game references, and a killer soundtrack. Absolutely brilliant. Into a unique cinematic experience. Safe to say we're probably all bringing some insights and enthusiasm to this one. We'll explore the film's innovative style, memorable characters, and lasting impact on the pop culture, which it feeds on so readily and effectively. So grab your controllers and your bass guitar as we get ready to press start on an epic discussion that's sure to be as action-packed and entertaining as the film itself. Let's jump right into the world of Scott Pilgrim. And we'll begin, as we always do, before we get into our little sections, by just going around the table, as it were, and asking, do you remember the first time that you saw Scott Pilgrim, and what were your initial thoughts? And, Whaley, we'll come to you, because you're the guest. Why not?
I saw it at the theater. I went, like Edgar Wright, so I was like, oh, good, this movie looks really cool. I was not aware of the graphic novels. Like, I mean, when the movie got announced, I saw the trailer, like, I was like, oh, cool, and I've never gone back to them, but like, I was like, oh, this seems like an awesome premise. I love video games. I love Edgar Wright, and I was like, I like music. So I was like, this seems like it'd be really fun, and went to the theater and absolutely loved it. So, So 2010, I was in the theater at some point. I don't remember.
Yeah. Did you know that it was kind of coming before? Like, did you see any trails or previews for it? Or was it just being an Edgar Wright fan, you were kind of had your ear to the ground with regard to that?
I think I saw trailers. Like, I'm a big fan of movie trailers. And I think I probably saw the trailer either. I don't remember my use of the internet at the time, because now it's like used to be at the theater, you'd be like, oh, cool, movie trailers, stuff I can see. And I don't see this all over the internet all the time, but I don't remember. I think 2010 was still pretty good at, like, online you watched them. So, like, I may have seen the trailer online prior, but I know that so it could have been before another movie. It could have been online. I'm not sure. But I do remember seeing the trailer and been like, and I think one of the original trailers, it was like, there may have been a from Edgar Wright, director of Shaun of the Dead, or, you know, just something along those lines. And I was like, oh, shit. This is something immediately by there I wanted to see it, then saw the trailer. I'm like, oh, this looks amazing. I think Michael Cera's hilarious. And, you know, and I was like, this has tons of awesome people in it. So it's had me sold by the first 10 seconds of the trailer. So
awesome. Cool. How about you, GK? Can you remember the first time that you saw this and what your initial reaction was to it?
I think I saw the trailer. I remember seeing the trailer when I was at work. Obviously getting a lot of work done. And I like the look of it, even though at that point I wasn't a big Michael Cera fan, because I'd never seen Arrested Development at that point.
Oh, I was going to say.
Yeah, I've made up for it since then.
Good.
But I never saw it at the theater. I think there was a couple of movies that year that I ended up loving, like this and Kick-Ass, that I never saw at the theater. Saw it when it came out a little while after, and just absolutely fell in love with it. I had no idea about the graphic novels. Then went out and bought every single one of the graphic novels. Got the video game. I just became instantly obsessed with it. So, I've loved it ever since.
Awesome. I can vividly remember this, weirdly enough, because sometimes I'm a little bit hazy, but I say it vividly. I can remember that we were at the cinema to see something else, me and my brother, but I can't remember what that was when we saw the trailer for this. And even before, because I think the first trailer for us in the UK didn't really mention Edgar Wright, weirdly enough. So even before knowing it was an Edgar Wright movie, I saw the trailer and was like, that looks awesome. I really want to make a point to say we're going to come back and see that. So we did decide, like, there and then, as soon as it comes out, we'll come and see it. And then obviously did a little bit of research, found out it was Edgar Wright, and was kind of like, even better. Awesome. Like you, before the film came out, I actually went and bought all 7 of the little graphic novels. Absolutely love them. Still do. Often reread them. And yeah, obviously it's what they call a transmedia narrative, apparently, this film and all of the kind of surrounding stuff to do with it, because, as you know, they've done video games, Adult Swim kind of cartoon things, the Netflix animated show, and they all tell different stories but within the same kind of framework. So it's more than just a movie, suffice to say. And I have to say, I've consumed every bit of it. I saw it at the cinema. I've owned it on kind of Blu-ray and now 4K. I've seen all of the other bits and pieces. And like I said, read the books regularly. And I just love it. I even watched the kind of COVID script read that they did, where they just got everyone back together via Zoom just to read the script out, which was like, come on. These are like really big stars. They were big then, they're even bigger now, and they still agreed to come back and do that as like a charity thing. So that was pretty awesome. Yeah, so that's safe to say. I think we're all pretty much going to be on board with this film. I don't think any of us are going to say, well, this is garbage. But yeah, I have to say, I'm disappointed in the initial reaction that it got, though, because I thought the trailer looked amazing and was like, oh, this film's going to be big. And then it's one of those movies that just, for whatever reason, didn't find an audience, didn't really hit. And it's shocking to me even now how many people still don't know it exists. Because one of those, if you know it, then, like I said, you're really in that world. You're deep diving into it. You know every little thing. But as I was kind of discussing it, that we were going to review it on Discord and even with our friend Nita from the Sci-Fi Queens and stuff, a load of people, most of the people were just like, I've never seen that, never heard of it. Is it any good? And I'm just like, wow, feels so sad.
We are in an awful timeline where the Michael Bay Transformers does a shitload of money, and this is very under-recognized.
But so, if you're watching this and you haven't seen Scott Pilgrim and you're at all interested in the worlds of like video games, comic books, graphic novels, youth culture, comedy, any number of things, please watch the movie and give it a try. Because if we do nothing else here today, at least hopefully we can get it a bit more noticed, because there's still far too many people that haven't seen the Blummin' thing. So that's my rant over with. We're going to move into the section before we get into the review, which is just a little bit of behind the scenes information. And as always, this is the purview of our very own BTS maestro, DK. So DK, I'm handing the controller over to you to take the player one slot. What have you got for us for the behind the scenes on this one?
Yeah, this is where we all die. Scott Pilgrim vs. the World is a 2010 romantic action comedy film co-written, produced and directed by Edgar Wright, and based on the graphic novel series Scott Pilgrim by Brian Lee O'Malley. It stars Michael Cera, Scott Pilgrim, together with an ensemble cast that includes Mary Elizabeth Winstead, Brandon Routh, Kieran Culkin, Anna Kendrick, Aubrey Plaza, Brie Larson, Chris Evans and Jason Schwartzman. Following the release of the first volume of O'Malley's comics, a film adaptation of the story was proposed, with Wright attached to the project from very early in development. The book's publisher, Oni Press, contacted producer Mark Platt to propose a film adaptation. Universal Studios contacted director Edgar Wright, who had just finished the 2004 release Shaun of the Dead, and agreed to adapt the comics. Wright himself had become interested in making the film when given a pre-release copy of the first graphic novel during the press tour for Shaun. O'Malley originally had mixed feelings about the film adaptation, stating that he expected them to turn it into a full-on action comedy with some actor that he hated. Though he also didn't even care, admitting, I was a starving artist and I was like, please just give me some money. Filming began in Toronto, March 2009, and wrapped in August of that same year. The film premiered at San Diego Comic-Con on July 22nd, 2010, and received a nationwide release in North America on August 13th. It was re-released for its 10th anniversary in the UK on August 21st, 2020, and the US on April 30th, 2021. It The film uses famous features of its Toronto setting and matches a style of video game and comic book imagery. It used real musical artists, including Beck and Metric,
woo,
as a basis for each fictional group in the Battle of the Bands plot, with some of the actors also performing. A combination of digital and physical methods were used to create the extensive visual effects. Although it was a box office bomb that failed to recoup its $85 million production budget, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World received positive reviews from critics who noted its visual style and humour, and garnered a cult following. Do I have to say it, folks? The film has since gone on to make several top 10 lists, and it has received over 70 awards and nominations. So, awesome. Over to you. Mike.
Yeah, awesome. There's a lot we could say about this film. It's one of those things, either you know about it or you don't. And if you don't, like I said, hopefully we've turned you onto it, and you may go out and seek out the film, the graphic novels, the Netflix series, and whatever else. But we're going to review it as we normally do, though, with this being a regular Silver Screen episode. We probably could have put this under cult classics, but we decided to go with Silver Screen regular flavor because, I don't know.
Because Mike just loved it.
I didn't want to give this one to DK, yeah, entirely, because it was my choice. So we're going to break it down the way we always do, which is into little sections that we stick roughly to, discussing like writing, plot, directing, acting, etc. If you've been with us a while, you know all of this, of course. But again, if the conversation takes us a different way, we just go with it. So it's not strict and it's not rigid. So I will start by jumping into the writing and the plot, because that just happens to be the first thing I've got in my notes. And I have a little bit of information to go on this. But first of all, DK, do you have anything? In case I step on any of your things here.
I've just got one thing. Okay. The original concept for Scott Pilgrim, it's based around two premises. The first was the idea of what if, after a life of playing street fighting games, someone confronted you and you actually had the ability to fight like a Street Fighter character. The second concept came about when Brian Lee O'Malley was dating his future wife, Hope Larson. When he learned that she dated three different guys named Matthew, O'Malley came up with the idea of a League of Matthews. This idea developed into the League of Evil Exes. And Matthew Patel is the only Evil Ex to keep the name Matthew. So, yeah, that's all I've got with regards to the writing.
Awesome. I have a fair bit, like I said, because I know a lot about this because I'm steeped in the lore, so to speak. So I will tell you that Michael Bacall, one of the writers, said that he wanted to write the Scott Pilgrim film because he felt strongly about its story and empathized with its characters. Put my teeth in. Wright said that O'Malley, obviously the comic book creator, was very involved with the script of the film from the start, contributing lines and adding polish. Due to the long development, several lines from various scripts written by both Edgar Wright and Bacall were used in later Scott Pilgrim comics. The screenplay's second draft, which O'Malley said, quote, became the main draft for the film, was submitted right at midnight on the night the writer's strike was supposed to begin in October 2007. No material from Scott Pilgrim's Finest Hour, the sixth Scott Pilgrim volume, appeared in the film, as the comic was not complete at the time of the film's production. O'Malley contributed suggestions for the film's ending and gave the producers his notes for the sixth volume, but stated that the film's ending was their ending. Some ideas for the film's ending were cut before production, including that Scott would turn out to be a serial killer who fantasized the gaming aspects, and that Gideon would turn into a Transformers-style robot. So it all comes back to Cybertron. There we go. In the film's original ending, written before the release of the final Scott Pilgrim book, Scott gets back together with Knives. You can find that on the DVD or so, physical media or whatever. O'Malley objected to the first ending because he felt it would dilute Knives' character. After the final book in the series, in which Scott and Ramona get back together, was released, and with divided audience reaction to the film's original ending, a new ending was filmed to match the books, with Scott and Ramona getting back together. O'Malley helped write the new ending, and Wright called Knives actress Ellen Wong beforehand, thinking she might be disappointed at the change, but finding that she liked the idea. The final ending was shot 3 months before the film was released, and Wright says that it is actually his preferred ending. So, yeah. Is any of that news to you guys? Any of it shock you? Or any thoughts on any of that?
No, I pretty much knew that with the research I'd done. So, yeah.
I didn't know that they had thought about changing the end, or had thought about the other ending. I personally would not have liked it, him getting with Knives. Like, no. Getting back with that. Because, honestly, the age difference there is a... Mm. It, to me, is still a problem. I wanted him back with Ramona. Because I did think, too, Knives grew as a character and became not just about the person she's seeing. Mm-hmm. And became so I think that would have diluted her character, which is like what you said they talked about the writer. Yeah,
for sure. I'm glad you said that, because I feel the same way, and I know a lot of people didn't like the ending where Scott gets back with Ramona. And I have to be honest, at the time, I don't know why it is, but the age thing just went straight over my head. Maybe because I was younger, I don't know. It wasn't something that I was as bothered about back then, until obviously you see it now, and it's like, oof, very
iffy. Scott is a bit of a prick at the start.
That was one of my takes away from this, rewatching it for the first time in a couple of years, is just like, I mean, I do think he evolved. No, no, wrong. You can evolve as a character, and that's part of the point. But at the beginning of this, I was like, I don't like Scott at the start of this.
Yeah, it was the same. I just thought, God, I never picked up on it before. But this rewatch, I was like, this guy is such a douche.
I've kind of always seen that, but my objection is more that people nowadays, people that are very against the character, or people that think they have more kind of film literacy and stuff than everyone else, are always like, oh, the certain dude bros emphasize with Scott and don't realize that he's actually a jerk or whatever. And my particular takeaway is that, like, of course he is a jerk to begin with, but the whole point of the movie is that, like most movie characters, he goes through a journey and gets to the point of, you know, not being such a jerk by the end of it, as emphasized by the whole, you know, earn the power of self-respect. He's not fighting for love, he's fighting for his own life. And even the jokey idea of like facing your dark side and just being like, well, he's an okay dude, we're gonna get brunch, do you know what I mean? It's just kind of there's something in that, I think. And I do think the character goes through a growth that a lot of people ignore, because they're just like, he's a typical jerky guy, and I'm like, yeah, he's supposed to be, though. I don't think you're supposed to really empathize with him at the start of the movie. And you even lines like, you know, lines like Kim saying, oh, if your life had a face, I would punch it, you know. This is not the advice you would give to somebody who you think is doing things well, you know what I mean?
My take on it, though, is just I didn't remember, after when I watched it the first few times, thinking he was a jerk at the beginning of the movie. This was kind of a new revelation, and it may just be me growing as a person since the first time I saw it too. But it's like when you're a kid, you watch Star Wars, you don't think Luke's whiny.
Yeah.
Star Wars, you think, but he's a kid. All kids are whiny to an extent. That's just one of the takeaways of different things I remember differently from when I watched it yesterday to when I watched it originally, and you know, and a few times in between since then. It's just been a few years. Like, I was just like, oh, I don't remember disliking him this much. Don't get wrong. At the end, he grew, he learned. Yeah. That's the whole point. Like, he had an arc, which is what he needed to make him a good character. But it's just still like, he's kind of shitty.
I think a lot of people, like I said, don't tend to notice this. And this isn't me going, oh, I'm so much wiser, I'm picking up on these things. But a lot of people don't notice that, like you said, he's not. It kind of points out to you throughout that he's a bit of a jerk, and he has to learn these things. I'm thinking of the scene specifically when he kind of has the argument with Ramona right after the fight with Roxy, and she's like, you know, oh, you're just another evil ex waiting to happen. And that's exactly the kind of crux of the character. And it's another thing I've picked up on. I don't know if you would call it writing or direction, but one of the ongoing motifs of the film is that Scott is associated with the number, if you could call it that, zero. So he is kind of classed amongst the evil exes, who all have like references to their numbers, like the number 3 on Todd's shirt, for example. And Scott is seen wearing like t-shirts with 0 on. That's the reason for the kind of quirky, he only drinks Coke Zero thing. He constantly gets told by people, you're a nobody, you're a zero. So it is there. It's the whole point is you're supposed to think at this point he is just another evil ex, and he, until he grows and gets beyond that, he's not going to be a character you should really be considering, you know, somebody that you should look up to, really. But
Well, just him as the protagonist to start, because he's the one they're following I'm saying it's odd, but it's just like, I guess I would just, because in my head from rewatching it, it was, you know, he's the lead. You're supposed to, he's supposed to be a likable guy, blah, 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 like that. But the whole point is for him to grow. It struck me more than it ever had before, than just like, oh, he's a douchebag when it comes to women. Like, I mean, he also was young, but
yeah.
And, you know, I probably was there. I don't know that I was a douchebag. I wouldn't have not broken up with somebody if somebody else came along, and I would have not.
You know, he's like with Ramona and then doesn't break up with Knives. And I'm like, come on, dude, this is really dodgy behavior. I mean, yeah. You can laugh at it and the way that he kind of, you know, exasperatedly tries to keep them apart and stuff. But there's some amusement to be had. But if you're looking at that as aspirational instead of just what a pathetic loser, then honestly, you're looking at it wrong, you know?
I'm more mad. The Knives thing, like, you could barely say they were dating, like, sort of thing. The Kim thing is where I don't like what he did. Like, yeah, how he...
The thing is, you say that, but Knives specifically, you know, comes out with that she loves him. So
I know, but
from his point of view, oh, they were barely dating, but from her POV, it's not really, you know, you've kind of got to consider the other person's feelings a bit.
But also, yeah. This is where the problematic part comes in with her age. He was an older guy who showed interest in her, and she, not probably having any experience with guys prior to that, her first thought is love, because she doesn't understand what it is. And so, like I said, that's where, like, the little bit of problematic between their age and the power dynamic came in. That's why, like, he was dating a person who was his own age and stuff like that, and then treated her like shit before he got to Knives, like, sort of thing. The Knives one is just like, he was just dating somebody that he liked and showed interest in him. He wasn't super serious about it. Now, because she was, don't be wrong, there's problems there, like, you know, but it's still, like, I still felt it was worse what he did to Kim than what he did to Knives.
Yeah, and you don't see a lot of that. I mean, I know it's one of the things that they explore in the kind of spin-off animations and things like that, but for me, that was just more an example of kind of world-building, that, you know, these characters have a history. They didn't just, you know, arrive then and there. And that's one of the things I like about the movie as well, is that very rarely do you have characters who exist before the 2 hours that you're watching. And
this,
you know, it doesn't hold your hand or take you through everything, but, you know, like you said, the kind of whole Scott and Kim relationship thing, it's not focused on. It's just a background thing. You never stop the movie and hear, you know, oh, this is what happened and exactly, you know, the situation and why I was wrong. But he does. It's one of the things he apologizes for at the end when he's
learned
that lesson as well. So it is important, but the movie doesn't feel the need to kind of hold your hand through it. It does that with a lot of the things. I mean, okay, you do get the animated flashbacks to Ramona's kind of encounters with the evil exes, you know, even with the kind of ridiculous, funny, he punched a hole in the moon kind of idea and all that, which is, it's absurd, but it's supposed to be a lot of the films like that. And but like I said, it's just weird that you have that backstory as opposed to just we dated and that's it. And it's nice. I like a little bit.
Well, it's also part of setting up his arc too. I understand why it's there, but I'm talking, you know, my just take is Scott Pilgrim as a person. It was another way to show that he was shitty with women, and it was something to use to get him to grow, which is fine. I just personally, like, out of the two indiscretions that he made, I thought the Kim's was worse.
Absolutely. And I mean, not that this excuses his behavior, but it's another example, I think, of kind of the way that these characters have history, in that he was kind of screwed over by Natalie/Envy.
Yeah.
As well. You know, so you kind of have that. I'm not
like, where it's that whole, I don't want to say trope, because it does happen, it repeats that on other people.
Yes. Yeah.
It's just like, oh, this is how it happens. I don't give a shit. That happened to me. It can happen to you too. Like, it's a real shitty take, but the world, a lot of people in the world do that. Like, they take it out on other people. So.
Well, I mean, there is that famous phrase, isn't it? Hurt people. But you've got to kind of break the cycle somewhere, which is why, like I said, I like the end of the movie when he's kind of,
for sure,
you know, he accepts this thing. He kind of lifts the burdens off himself. He says, you know, young Neil, you're great, you're fantastic, Kim, I'm sorry for what I did to you. Oh, do you really want to fight me for her? No, I want to fight you for you. And then the literal visualization of, you've learned the power of self-respect, which is pretty good. It's a good moment. DK, I'm aware we've been talking over you a few times, so anything that you wanted to say before I jump on?
I was just gonna say, I do find, you know, knowing where I know, kind of amusing with regards to the age difference between Scott and Knives, because in reality, Alan Wong is like 3 years older than Michael Cera.
Really? I didn't actually know that. But okay.
Yeah.
It doesn't surprise me.
What I wanted to bring up, and I'm kind of going to bring you guys into to ask you about this, is that obviously one of the things that the film is kind of famous for and that I like about it is kind of pop culture references, and that can be game culture, music culture, youth culture. I've literally only made a couple of examples, but for example, when Knives first turns up at the band, you know, the rehearsal, and sits next to, I think it's young Neil, and says, "What do you play?" referring to instruments, and then he kind of goes, "Oh, well, lots of things, Zelda, Mario, etc." You know, that's a big question. And I was kind of like, yeah, that's kind of what I'm referring to, the kind of the almost transgressive nature of, like, we are a member of all of these cultures and they're all equally important. And yeah, the youth dialogue and everything, I think, is pretty snappy, but it's also, it can be quite damning of youth. Like, for example, when Scott gets the warning email, it's one of my sort of favorite gags, that he's reading through this really intense thing about, it's come to my attention, we're going to fight and I'm going to have to, and his reaction to that is just, this is so boring, just delete it. And when Patel actually attacks him, it's like, well, I skimmed it, you know. So it's you know, the youth can kind of see themselves and relate, but at the same time, there's some cool elements to that, and there's some elements that's like, by the way, you're not perfect, your attention span sucks, you know. So I wouldn't say it's, like I said, it's idolizing youth necessarily either, but it's kind of nice to see these references within yourself. And even just little funny things like, have you seen this one girl with hair like this? And he's just done a little sketch, like the Leo Malley sketch, you know?
Yeah.
It's fun. It's quirky. And so my point was going to be, do you have any favorite kind of references from any of these kind of cultural things, or just youth and quirky dialogue that sticks out to you, or that's your favorite amongst the many in the movie? DK, I'm going to come to you, because, like I said, we've been talking very over you, so I'm going
to
ask you
first. I love the fact that when they go to sleep, it plays the sleeping music from Zelda.
Oh, I didn't even know that. Fair enough.
In hindsight, I know that, but now I didn't catch it when I watched it. That's great.
That's awesome. So is there any, like, dialogue or anything that you, like, a reference to something you're a particular fan of that you were like, oh, it was cool to hear that mentioned, or?
Not so much that. I mean, there's some really good, like, little lines in there. Mm. You know, where he's talking to his sister and she says, can you see a future with this girl? And he's, what, like, with jetpacks?
That is actually my favorite line.
Yeah. And, you know, when it goes to the club and it comes up on screen, fun fact, this place is a toilet. And, you know,
yeah,
and when he says, I don't know the meaning of the word, and it comes up, he says, he really doesn't.
He really doesn't. That's I've got that kind of under direction, but that's one of the other things I love, is that it uses other things besides dialogue and stuff, and things that, the tropes of, like, comic books and video games, as you said, like the on-screen information boxes. And it's some of the more effective gags, and I'm trying to think off the top. I don't want to get into too many because we'd be here all day, but, like, I think my favorite is at the very start when they're pointing out that Scott doesn't own anything in the house. And it's just like, it goes through the entire room and all these boxes come up, but it's like, Wallace owns this, 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 this.
Yeah, it's very, it's kind of like that Fight Club thing where it's going round.
But I mean, even like when he pees, he has a pee bar, like a video game that goes down and appears on screen.
Yeah.
Or I've completely forgotten what reason it is that it comes up, but there's a point where, like, a narrator just breaks into the film and starts narrating something. One of them, I think, is the thing you'd refer to, which was just like, I don't even know the meaning of the word. He actually doesn't. Blah, blah, blah. So, yeah. But there's a whole thing like that where the narrator breaks in and it just comes out of nowhere. And like I said, you could be here all day listing the references. I love that they use the little Seinfeld music sting and then the kind of canned laughter studio audience stuff. Again, just out of nowhere, randomly.
Yeah, so, I do love that little section. And that's what sold me on it in the trailer when I saw it.
Oh,
where
okay.
The little icon comes up of his face, his animated face. And he says, what are you doing? I'm getting a life.
Yes. Yeah. Or even, I mean, similar to that, because that is fantastic, but similar to that, and the moment that completely passed me by on the first few watches, when Knives is kind of shocked to see the clash at Demon Head and her face becomes an emoji. She's like, oh, wow, ka-ting.
Yeah.
That is so weird and yet kind of cool. So, yeah, what about you, Michael? Is there anything that particularly sort of stands out to you that you wanted to shout out quickly?
Not off the you guys listed a bunch of them that I was thinking about. For reference stuff, I don't know if it's you stuff. I mean, there was a, and I can't remember off the top of my head, but I remember laughing hysterically when Chris Evans is playing an exaggerated version, and he says something that referenced something else, but now my brain can't think of what it is. But that was a reference that I really liked. But I can't, you guys listed a ton of the ones that I liked. I can't think of any off the top of my head.
Yeah, because I mean, like I said, it doesn't even have to be specific. The Chris Evans character is a great kind of stereotype of the over-the-top macho film star who could be a number of things. I mean, there's a little bit of Taken in the whole, like, the second click will be me pulling the trigger or whatever. Yeah. And there's a little bit of all of the big action stars. There's the Tom Cruise doing your own stunts thing and you know, a little bit of everything, just your old cocky action star. But a lot of the characters, I think, are exaggerated versions, but it just really works because you know what they're parodying. And because they're in a world where crazy shit happens, like, you know, people explode into coins and stuff anyway.
For sure.
So, yeah. Which actually brings me to my next point, which is that one of the things which I think has put off some people that watch the film and are very literal minded, and I can kind of appreciate it, is the absurd and surrealist elements of the movie. Because like I said, you kind of have to either be all in and accepting of it or not. And it's kind of impossible to explain it to people if they don't get it and they don't sort of, like I said, if you're a literal thinker and you're like, well, clearly people aren't just being killed and exploding into coins and having these fireball video game type battles and stuff. And I'm just like, yeah, but you've got to just either, you know, suspend your disbelief and go with it. It's the old, you know, you'll appreciate this, DK. It's the old, you know, MST3K. It's just a show.
Oh,
relax,
yeah.
Kind of logic.
And if you are immersed in this, you know, especially video game culture, you don't, I mean, I don't know what you think because you're not as much of a gamer, but I know you used to be. You know, you just kind of just take it on board. I don't think twice about people exploding into coins. It just, it's part of that universe.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. This was obviously a comic book and video game movie. Anybody who knows a comic book and a video game knows what this is. Like, I don't know what anybody else would be thinking of it for that, but, you know, like, you can't pick and choose a suspension of disbelief in this film. Yeah. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, and that's, and I'm wrong. I've seen with other movies, people are like, oh, well, it didn't do this. I was like, but you believed this in that movie, but not this? Like,
Yeah.
Like, point, yeah. Your choice of suspension of disbelief is odd.
Absolutely, but I think it's one of those movies that, for me, part of the reason that it doesn't bother me, even though I can be literal-minded at times, is that it clues you in like so many other ways that this is a heightened unreality. Like I said, from the characters all being ridiculously over the top, like almost stereotypes, to the little touches. Again, it's technically direction, but I'll bring it up. Like when they're having the fights and you get that kind of anime rush effect in the background and stuff, and it's kind of like all this stylization, not to mention the stuff we've already said, like the narration and the info boxes and stuff like that. This already clues you into, like I said, that you're not watching a slice of life documentary. You know, this isn't Ken Loach. You're watching something that is specifically stylized. So I don't have an issue with that. But I will say just quickly, my last kind of thought on this was they commented on this, right, and O'Malley, and said, quote, "This is merely the internal perspective of how Scott understands himself and the world," which if you need that, fair enough. If you need that explanation and you want a headcanon that, cool. And I do kind of, I snickered a little bit and I'm glad they didn't go there. But the idea that Scott was kind of a serial killer that's just, you know, in his own mind's eye, he's massacring people, but seeing the blood as coins and stuff like that. It's a funny idea, but I'm glad they didn't go there because, like I said, that brings it a bit too into reality for me. So. Yeah,
I think that would be such a tonal change at the end to find that out that it just kind of would be off-putting for the movie in general.
Yeah, completely. I think I have a few other little bits and pieces, but not much. So do you guys have any thoughts on what I mentioned, the kind of absurd and surrealist? I'm presuming it wasn't really a kind of something that stopped you guys from getting involved in the film.
No, never thought twice of it, just accepted it.
Same. Yeah. I think if it would have not been that, I wouldn't have liked the movie as much.
Yeah.
Like, and I mean, you just think of it from a perspective of just like, just say that you do have to fight someone's evil exes in order to get with them.
Exactly.
Like, if you did that, even if you did it without a video game, without the comic book aspect of it, I just don't know. Like, it would seem like more of a serious movie. Like, that wouldn't be played as a comedy unless it was like slapstick. I don't know. It just seems like it just wouldn't have, I don't think tonally it could work.
Yeah, completely. And to your point, like you said, DK, like I not that heavy of a gamer now and haven't been for a while, but I did used to be. But one thing I am heavily into and have been for a long time is comic books. And the film, as much as it's a video game kind of movie, it's also a comic book film.
Yeah.
And that part I did understand, the fact that it's kind of visually it looks like a comic. And like I said, I'd read the sort of 7 graphic novels before seeing the movie. So you can't start reading those graphic novels and then, you know, put it down and be like, well, this is unrealistic, because of course it is. That's the point. You know, if you're picking up a Spider-Man comic going, well, that guy could never climb up walls, this is nonsense, then you're in the wrong place. You know what I mean? So, but yeah, so I, like I said, I kind of like that. And I think we would probably all be in agreement that that's one of the strengths, actually, of the film, perhaps. So cool. Yeah, I kind of, to my initial point, I forgot to mention, like, the idea that I said the characters have a history and kind of everything keeps happening even when the main players aren't on screen and the main plot isn't happening. Little things like the Wallace stealing Stacey Pilgrim's boyfriends and having these horrid gay affairs in the background and stuff. No reason why that's there, but it's really funny and it just works. And it's one of those little things that when I was watching it with a more analytical eye, I didn't give it a second thought watching it as a kind of just a movie viewer. And then watching it to analyze, I was like, yeah, that's another thing that's like, it's just there, but it's funny. It works. Why not? You know? And it gives
Wallace is such a likable character.
Yeah, despite being a bit of a jerk, actually.
Yeah.
In his own way, you know? Because like I said, I think you laugh with him and he has that... He's the kind of dry deadpan humor of like, look out, it's that one guy, you know, or, you know, when Lucas Lee's like, yeah, you're lucky I don't have my board. And then he just turns up with it. He's like, big fan. Here you go.
See, I just think Wallace was trying to help Scott's sister by like keeping her from trying to date someone who's obviously gay.
Yeah. Like, well, yeah, there's yeah. that as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like he's just helping her. It's just it's funny that it keeps happening because she is choosing
yeah.
men who either don't realize or
yeah, absolutely. And they, I mean, they're still clearly friends because there is that ongoing joke as well about like Scott can say something to Wallace and he can be basically unconscious and he's texting, you know, Stacey, and then she'll ring like a second later and be like, Scott, you're dating in high school. How did you even know? How do you do that? But yeah, that's kind of cool. Again, this is kind of off the particular area that we're in, but I have to say that as well, that like the casting of this film is incredible. When you look at a film that's got Aubrey Plaza and Anna Kendrick in basically minor background roles, you're yeah. like, come on, this is just... And they're great in it, even though they don't really have that much to do. I mean, Aubrey Plaza practically steals the film with that. Like, how are you doing that with your mouth? Never you mind how I'm doing that with my mouth. It's just... Just got a load of kind of examples of the kind of quirky humor and stuff in the movie. So forgive me, but hopefully, you know, if I mention something that it might stop us getting references in the comments and stuff. So I have to say, I love the, what's it, Crash and the Boys, the band. And then somebody shouting, is that girl also a boy? So she just gives them the finger. And then Kim being so kind of put out that they have a girl drummer is kind of amusing. But my favorite joke of that is that, like, this song is all about, like, oh, the melancholy and the sadness of life. And this long explanation, and then it's like the start of the song, and it just goes, so sad. Thank you. That was that was the whole song. Like, the explanation was longer. I love it. Like I said, to the point that, like, Lucas Lee's a bit of a, you know, the stereotypical arrogant asshole, basically, when Wallace says, big fan, and his response is, why wouldn't you be? the ongoing thing about, you know, you need to break out the L word, what, lesbian? No, the other L word, lesbians. Yeah. little sly references. Oh, this was another kind of, this is a pop culture reference that would have went over a lot of people's heads, but I kind of appreciated it. It was, oh, this, I have to go and hang out with my stupid ex-girlfriend. Is that the Uma Thurman movie? Because I watched that movie.
I have too.
Yeah, it's not terrible. I mean, it's bad, but it's not terrible. I love that you punch the highlights out of her hair. Again, you kind of just have to accept the absurd things. So yeah. When something like that happens, you're either on board or you're not, really. The whole cleaning lady conversation with Brandon Routh's character is... It shouldn't work, but it really does. And even Scott's line afterwards, you know, you once were a vegan, now you will be gone. It's nonsense and stupid. And I think, is it Envy or somebody even goes like, vegan?
I think it's actually Brendan Rose's character says that. Or maybe...
Oh, yeah, yeah. And Just on a kind of, you know, film analysis level, I did note that the film does the very obvious thing where the character kind of hits a low point right before the resurgent, realizing his worth and coming, learning a lesson. And in this case, Scott literally dies. He gets killed at his lowest point and then has to get a life, which is a brilliant kind of double meaning there as well. Which, again, there's a couple of things like that in the film. I also like that Ramona saying, "I just can't help myself around Gideon," is very kind of, it's relatable from a real life kind of, you know, that metaphor becomes, no, literally he's got a chip that controls my brain. It was like, all right, okay, cool. And the last thing I want to say about the writing is that there's a line that I had never noticed before, which is obviously very meta, which is when they're entering the club at the end, as people having a conversation, and all you can hear of the conversation is, he says the comic book is way better than the movie. I was like, that's a bold thing to put in a movie adapted from a comic book, but okay. So do you have any other thoughts on the writing, just anything at all, before I move to acting?
No, you've pretty much said it as far as I'm concerned.
So yeah, it was great. A lot of fun things in there, but yeah, you covered most of it.
Awesome. Well, again, I don't want to step on your toes, so I'll come to you first, DK. Do you have anything on the acting before I jump in with my bits and pieces?
I've just got one of two things. Wright told his casting director not to hire any English actors, as this was his first North American film. Satya Barber, who played Matthew Patel, though, successfully passed the audition with a non-English accent. He later revealed he was from London.
I've seen him in New Girl. I know he's English.
Ellen Wong, who plays Knives, she auditioned three times and landed the role when the director learned she held a green belt in Taekwondo. When training for their fight scenes, the choreographer was so impressed with her skills, he dubbed her the Ellenator. Because it's a comic book movie, Wright proposed that you very seldom see the actors blink. For example, Kim Pine only blinks once during the entire movie. She only breaks her gaze three times. She lowers her eyes twice and has her eyes closed when announcing Sex Bob on for the last time. And that's all I've got, really, for the acting.
Cool. Well, I literally only have one thing as well, but I just thought it was interesting, which is that Edgar Wright obviously has an incredible eye for casting, particularly around the kind of things that would feed into this kind of pop culture world. He filled the film with people who could and often soon would be superheroes. To give you an idea of how appropriately superheroic this lot are, the lineup includes the once or future Superman, Captain America, Captain Marvel, Lego Robin, Royal Pain, Human Torch, Punisher, and the Atom. All in this movie. And in some cases, the same person more than once. Yeah, so, yeah, pretty impressive. If you haven't seen all those, go watch them all. They're all great. But anyway. I'm going to kind of throw the doors open, because I've talked a lot, and a lot of that has been about the kind of characters and the actors of it. So I'm going to throw it open to you guys and say, is there something that you wanted to bring up specifically about the acting that you thought was noteworthy? And Michael, I'll come to you first this time. Why not?
I think everybody was cast really well, and all the acting was, I mean, it comes down to directing too with it, but like, it was everything it needed to be. Like, I didn't think anything was like, oh, this person stood out more than this other person. I think everybody was pretty perfect for what they were trying to do. Like, Jason Schwartzman playing the Gideon, just is, he's so good at characters like that. And like I said, I think it almost comes down to perfect casting for some of these. Now, granted, these are actors. They can do all sorts of different things, but I think everything came down to everything was exactly as it should be. So like, I can't think of anything that was like, oh, I wish somebody would have been better, but because I think everybody was pretty perfect for their character.
Yeah. I mean, I know it's probably a controversial statement, especially from people that have watched films for, you know, decades, but I think this might be my favorite ensemble cast in a film. I don't think there's a weak link. And I think they're all actors who I've loved in this and in other things. And in a couple of cases, like I said, they're playing roles that are so far removed from both their personalities and the kind of roles they would go on to play or had played before. And it would be so easy for to play that so broad that it comes off terrible. But I'm thinking specifically like Chris Evans and Brie Larson, for example, play characters who are polar opposites of what you would expect them to be. You know, they are not Captain America and Captain Marvel in this film, for example. So, and like I said, that could come off kind of really badly, but I don't think it does. I think it works in the kind of tone and the overall kind of sense of the film. Yeah. What about you, DK? Any thoughts you have on any of the...
You've both pretty much summed it up. There isn't one performance that lets this group down. They're all pretty much pitch perfect.
Yeah. One quick thing to hop on, you're there, Michael. I will say this, though. It wasn't like Captain America, but it was a little like Johnny Storm, which he was doing.
It was a little human joke.
He had already done the first Captain of Fantastic Four, and the next one, I think he was either filming or came out the year after.
Not just that character, but looking at, for example, I'd seen Brandon Routh in Superman Returns. He is the only good thing about that movie. And yet, like you say, his character here is so different, the whole cocky cock thing. And I mean, I fell in love with Brie Larson when I watched this film for the first time. And yet, I can never quite believe it's actually her, because the character, she gets so lost in this Envy character that it's completely different than anything I've seen her do. And I love her anyway. Don't get me wrong, I love all of her other movies, the dramatic, the superhero, whatever, but it's just such a different character, and she throws herself into it, bless her, the entire way. And, by the way, does her own singing, which is even more bloody impressive.
She is very good.
I think we've kind of already alluded to it, but I think Michael Cera's comedic chops go a long way to making you, even though you know not to kind of like this guy, there's a certain level of charm to him, even when he's doing stuff that's terrible. Like when he's kind of, the continue screen comes up when he's at the arcade with knives and he's kind of gesturing over like, you know, you cheap ass. But it's kind of done with such humor. And even though he's self-centered and he's ridiculous, just the sheer kind of relatable charm of him telling the kind of Pac-Man story to Ramona, and then just being like so embarrassed and like, I'm just gonna go away forever now. It's kind of like, you're a jerk, but I kind of relate to you in this moment. You know, in terms of the acting, I think Mary Elizabeth Winstead is probably the actor who I think gives the most quote-unquote normal performance, the most natural. She doesn't seem to be overly heightened or exaggerated, and she's quite similar to the way I've seen her act in a lot of other things. So she kind of has to, but again, that in a world that is this heavily stylized, that is within itself its own level of achievement to stay that kind of grounded and trust that you're with a director who's not going to make you seem just out of place.
I think there was a couple actors that were quote unquote normal, like not over the top, like the other guy in the band, like there was a few of them sprinkled in, like his sister. I don't think she was over the top. Good. I mean, it grounded the movie to an extent to make it more relatable, because if everybody was just over the top, super comic-y, and I mean that not funny-wise, but like comic-based, like it wouldn't have played as well. So I think like the sprinkling in of the other performances kind of ground everything else, but also make the other ones pop too. So
yeah. Yeah, completely. And like I said, I've just got to shout it out for like what you might in any other film call the minor players. And so, like I said, Aubrey Plaza and Anna Kendrick, one heightened role, one kind of, as you said, relatively straight role, I guess. Or Alison Pill, who came to my attention for the first time in this movie, playing Kim. And again, when you get to Star Trek Picard, which you'll appreciate, DK, hard to believe it's the same actress. It's just kind of like, oh yeah, that's so weird. That was the chick from Scott Pilgrim.
Oh, shit.
Anyway.
I did not catch that.
Really? Is this news to you?
I didn't realize that was the same one.
Well, now you know. Yeah, so any thoughts, DK, then, in general, on, let's see, acting before I go to direction?
No, like I said, you pretty much summed it up with regards to the acting.
Okay, do you have anything to say about the direction, then, before we start going into it?
A couple of things. The 8-bit Universal logo at the beginning of the film was Edgar Wright's idea. It was then designed by his brother Oscar Wright, the concept designer and storyboard artist on the film. The logo seen in the final film was the first draft. It was not yet considered finished when test screenings began, but audiences reacted so positively to it that it was decided that no further work needed to be done. The first Battle of the Bands, when fighting the first Evil X, Scott is seen wearing a Plumtree t-shirt.
Yes.
Plumtree is an all-girl indie rock band that released the song Scott Pilgrim on their 1998 album, Predicts
the Future.
Yeah,
that's where the character's name comes from. I have that on
the Ironically, that song became the inspiration for O'Malley. Stated that the movie was done in the style of a musical, but instead of the characters breaking into song and dance, they break into a fight. The only exception, obviously, the battle between Scott and Matthew Patel is done in the style of a Bollywood fight scene.
Yeah, I only have one little thing before I get into like the talking about bits and pieces of the direction, which is obviously it was directed by Edgar Wright. And in his chapter on the comic in Icons of the American Comic Book, the author Dave Wallace wrote that Edgar Wright was the perfect choice to helm the Scott Pilgrim movie, given his experiences of directing the British sitcom Spaced. Shout out Spaced, that's fantastic. Like Scott Pilgrim, the characters of Spaced view the world through a filter that aggregated various elements of pop culture. And if you didn't know that and you haven't seen Spaced, please go and watch it. That's also where Shaun of the Dead came from.
Yeah,
from a scene at the start of an episode of Spaced where they see life like the Resident Evil game they're playing.
Yeah, Tim was obsessed with Resident Evil at that point, wasn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. So, we've kind of touched on, I think we've said a lot of stuff in the other sections, like I said, because we, you know, just go with it a lot of the time. So before I get into any of the things I've got, because I've got quite a lot of random crap about the direction, is there anything that you guys wanted to specifically bring up about it?
The direction, I think the direction is really good in this, because it's not, you know, video game and references aside, there's some beautiful framing in that shot, and I'm particularly thinking about the scenes on the swings in the snow.
Yes, I thought the same, absolutely, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, I just think it looks beautiful.
That's when it kind of, it leapt out to me, the kind of framing of that scene as well, but also the scene of, and I think it's actually because it's the same panel from the graphic novel, the scene of Scott and Ramona against the wall. When they're talking to each other, but they're both kind of facing forward. It's also framed in a very kind of, and there's a lot of things that, like you said, they're framed as if they could be comic book panels, and a lot of the film operates kind of in that exact way. If you bear with me, I have a quote about that. A technique that is described as giving the film its postmodern reading is how Wright seems to alter the film form to reflect elements inherent to comic book sequences, specifically that he consistently but judiciously quotes panel content throughout the film, generally using the illusion of stasis in film to mirror the illusion of movement in comics. Wright transcodes the construction of comic panels into the film, and he himself, Wright, has said that a lot of people have mentioned how it feels like reading a comic book, which, yeah, it absolutely does. And you can see the kind of the spatial remediation in the film, how the kind of it splits the image into like three things that are not, you know, continuous motion, but they operate in the same way as reading a comic would. So that even on a subconscious level, I think, like I said, you kind of, you realize that that's what you're doing, and you buy into this heightened world, hopefully. So, yeah, cool. Was that something that leapt out to you, Michael, about the kind of comic book nature of it?
Yeah, for sure. Like, I definitely, like, I know that when people get brought in to direct things that somebody else is, you know, based on some other things like that, they've got to know and love it in order to make it appear good. And I think you could tell Edgar Wright was a fan of doing of the comics to get it to visually come onto the screen like you are reading a comic, like you said. And I think that was, you know, extremely well done. And you've got to have the vision for that. It can't just be like, hey, you know, Christopher Nolan, you come direct this graphic novel that we have the idea for. You know, like it wouldn't work necessarily with someone who didn't at least research the source material and like the source material in order to bring it up to the screen correctly. Yeah. So and to have that vision to do it how it is done is what makes him fantastic.
Oh, completely. Yeah. And I just have to shout out a few things that like kind of feed into this that I think are just strokes of genius, even if they seem obvious. So, for example, being the kind of comic book style, there is, and any fans of Batman 1966 will appreciate this, there's kind of comic book onomatopoeia, as they call it, that appears on screen as the sounds are happening. So like the form will ring and the word ring will appear on screen and things like that, which, like I said, if you're a fan of Adam West, you'll have seen that kind of thing with the old sock pow boom situation. But again, it just clues you into what you're watching, I think, in a very nice way. There's some kind of funny whip pans of the camera and stuff, all things that kind of, like I said, add to this kind of unreality. You don't know, you know, you don't think you're watching a slice of life type situation. The way the lights fade behind people as they kind of go into flashbacks or, you know, their own kind of internal monologues or whatever. The use of the video game versus screens, which I really love, because, I mean, even though, as we've said, you know, ad nauseum, I'm not a huge gamer, one of the things I do love the video games genre is the fighting game. You know, I grew up playing, like, Mortal Kombat, Tekken, Street Fighter, etc., so I really love that every fight literally has to start with them facing like they're on a, you know, 2D fighting game and the word versus in between them. Yep. I love that. Another cool moment was the when Knives is asking about the status of their relationship, and you actually see the continue screen counting down behind Scott in the arcade.
Yeah,
a nice little kind of making it obvious. This is my favorite thing, and I don't know why, but I absolutely love it. Maybe because of who's involved, but I love that you see the Clash at Demon Head poster a few times, and then it's in a scene totally inconspicuously, you don't think anything of it, and then it actually literally becomes Envy, and she's just stood there in exactly the same pose as Michael Cera kind of like reacts with shock, and then the camera, you know, whip pans back, and it's actually her there. I love that moment. That's it. That's basically all I've got, other than to say, I mentioned kind of the Scott being the number zero of the evil X's. There is also an X motif that goes on, as in the letter X related to the evil X's. One of the things that's mentioned in the film is, of course, these what he thought were seven kisses, which became, you know, they were actually seven deadly X's. But more importantly, there's an X in the snow as Scott and Ramona go on their first date, as if it's been ploughed on a kind of cross section. Scott wears an X-Men X patch on his coat, which he rips off at one point. And when Scott and Gideon are fighting, they cross their swords, and it specifically makes an X, which the camera lingers on for a second. So, cool things like that. You know, I love that. It's got no bearing on anything, and it's super dorky, but I just love it. So, yeah. What's that on the direction before I move us along again?
I think it's just got an energy to it that, you know, that thumbs up the video game kind of style as it is, and it's, you know, it never lulls, it's never ponderous, it moves at a brisk pace, and I do like that. It's just got an energy about it that's all its own.
Awesome. Yeah. And what about you, Michael? Anything you want to say other than just to echo that, I guess?
Yeah, it's fantastic, and I think great direction.
Just eminently watchable and entertaining.
For sure.
Oh, that was the other thing I forgot to mention as well. Speaking of kind of recurring motifs, there's also a recurring thing about the number seven, obviously because of the seven X's.
Yeah.
But during that last fight, all of Gideon's stats are plus like 700 to whatever Scott's got. When he's finally destroyed, Scott gets 7 million or 7 billion coins.
Oh,
nice. Every time he hits him, it comes up with times 7 or 700 scores. So it just recurs a lot basically in those moments. So, which again, you don't really notice, but I kind of appreciate it on just a level of, oh, neat. speaking of that kind of thing, DK, did you have anything on the VFX and production design?
I've just got a couple of things. In Ramona's apartment, there's a poster for the movie Fargo. She would later go on to appear in the third season of Fargo.
Nice.
Her hair color, it corresponds with the colors of the three goddesses from Legend of Zelda.
How? I didn't know that either.
Yeah, and Scott's extra life icon and the sprite animation in the ending titles were designed for the movie by Paul Robertson, who also went on to design the character artwork in Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, the game.
Ah, fair enough. Well, he's basically just copying O'Malley's art, if you ask me, but whatever. Cool. I have a little bit about this, but that's literally, we've talked about everything else, so I just wanted to get this down and say that Edgar Wright apparently got the idea to have the opening sequence from Quentin Tarantino. After screening an early cut of the film for him, Tarantino told him that the film needed a title sequence at the start to let people settle in and hint more about what we were about to see. The original opening sequence had the film's title shown over the long living room band shot that comes before the title sequence, which Edgar Wright said was one of the first scenes to be storyboarded, with the cast credits then appearing at the end of the film initially. After an early mock-up of the title sequence on Avid, they approached Shinola to create it, as the film's graphic artists, Oscar Wright, as we mentioned in Double Negative, were too occupied with the other effects in the film at this point in production, and Edgar Wright was familiar with their work. So we have Tarantino to thank for the opening credit sequence, I guess. So yeah, any other thoughts on that? Or can we just move on from VFX and production? We've talked at length about the kind of the stylization and the little elements and things that were on there. So
yeah, I think we covered most all of it.
Cool. Do you have anything then, DK, on the music and sound before I jump in with my bits and pieces?
I do, and I'm saying this as an avid metric fan. Metric. It, weirdly enough, my first introduction to Metric was on another comic book inspired film, the Woody Harrelson thing, Defender. I don't know if you, either of you guys have seen that. The music on the end credits was Metric, and that's when I first heard them, and I was like, who the hell are these? I've got to listen to these. And yeah, I have all their albums. Nice. So yeah,
they're great.
Metric is the inspiration for Clash at Demon Head and contributed the song Black Sheep to the film by request of Nigel Godrich. The clothing, performance and style of Metric's lead singer, Emily Haynes, is also the basis for the lead singer, Envy Adams. The music journalist Janelle Sheets wrote that Larson's performance is similar enough to Haynes, but with an attitude appropriate to Envy Adams. Now, Larson as Envy Adams provides the vocals for Black Sheep in the film, while the soundtrack features the version of the song with Haynes as lead singer per the band's request. Larson's obviously a professional singer and she's performed in some of their other films. Metric had been performing the song at their concert since 2007, but had not released it before the movie. Todd Martins of the Los Angeles Times said that Envy is a caricature of Haynes, and likewise, according to Haynes, that Black Sheep is essentially a caricature of Metric, like a song emulating their most distinct aspects. Godrich agreed and added that it was perfect for this film because it's not Metric, it's a shadow of Metric. Now, Wright obtained permission to use the famous theme music from the Legend of Zelda SNES game by writing a letter to Nintendo saying that it is considered to be the nursery rhyme of this generation. It the film was heavily inspired by and features numerous references to Nintendo, such as the use of names, imagery, sound effects, and music from classic Nintendo games. Ironically, the video game adaptation of the film was only initially available for PlayStation and Xbox. So...
Typical.
Yeah. Yes, okay. That's what I've got as regards to the music.
I only have a little few things. You've kind of covered one of my my areas, but did you have something you wanted to add, Michael?
I just had some trivia that I saw on one of the things that tends to go for the music, that something I did not know about Michael Cera, the four cast members that made up Sex Bob-omb spent several weeks learning how to play together as a band. Mark Webber, Alison Pill, and Johnny Simmons all had to learn their instruments from scratch. However, Michael Cera had to dumb down his bass playing in order not to outshine his bandmates because he's evidently a very good bassist.
Yeah, or so he says.
Well, I mean, it just lists out there. He probably is. Here's the thing: a lot of when you work full time as an actor, you have time to learn and to do stuff like that.
That's fair.
Because you act once and that pays for a couple years worth of stuff. So if you don't act again for a couple years, you have time to learn to play music or any of the other.
Before I forget as well, even though it's a reference that completely goes over my head, I do appreciate that there's that moment where he plays the Final Fantasy music on the bass.
Yeah.
Check it out. I learned this. I have no idea what that is. I've never played a Final Fantasy game, but I still appreciate the reference.
So then, what?
Yeah, man, I told you I'm not a gamer.
I want to get thee to a nunnery.
No. But yeah, in terms of the music and sound, I will say, not to contradict you, but the version of the soundtrack album that I have digitally does actually contain both versions of Black Sheep. So it has the Metric version and the version with Brie Larson on lead vocals.
Might be a re-release then.
Yeah, that tends to happen sometimes with soundtracks. Like my Rocky Horror soundtrack that I have has the extra songs that the original soundtrack did.
But yeah, you were right about kind of Brie Larson's character being based on Haynes, but also quite heavily based on the character from the graphic novels as well. There are images out there, which I may try and find for the edit, if I can, of the actors who have been cast in the role doing poses from the comic book of their particular character, including one of Brie Larson in a side-by-side with Envy Adams. You can see in that image that Brie has the wrong color hair, because Envy Adams actually has red hair in the comics, but there was a screen test and you can find the pictures out there of Brie Larson with the exact same style, but her hair's red and it looks pretty good. I will just say it still works. Beck recorded many songs and cues for the film, as you said, including Everything by Sex Bob-omb. And again, I would shout out the official soundtrack. They're all on there and they're great. That gives us, basically our analysis, rather in-depth, of the film. We will come back with our, you know, favourite moments and conclusion and score, as we always do. But before that, we are going to hear from you, the audience, because many moons ago, when we were first going to record this, I did put out the prompt on social media asking some people what they thought of Scott Pilgrim. We didn't get a lot of responses, but I have got the one saved that we did get in my phone here. First of all, well, I can skip the one where Michael Whaley says he's a huge Edgar Wright fan because he's here. Perry Brooker, this is on my personal Facebook page, by the way, says, I've never heard of it. Like I said, gutting whenever you get that. Nick Lambrecht said, such a fun film, as a fan of both the comic and Wright. This is one of those movies that no matter where in the film it is, if I'm flipping channels, I will finish watching it. Maxwell Slaney says, I love Edgar Wright movies, including this one. Jared Hall said, Scott Pilgrim is one of my comfort movies. It got me through two deployments in the Navy. Wow, thanks for the service. And let's see, Andrew Outwater said, fantastic movie and a good litmus test. If people think Scott is the good guy, that person probably isn't as good as they think they are. Jared Hall replied, yes, it's crazy how many people don't see it. And Andrew replied, the entire arc of his character pivots on him realizing this. To which Jared replies, on a side note, epic baseball. Yeah. And I believe that's it. That's all of the feedback I got. Like, so we didn't have very much for whatever reason. Like I said, I've got a feeling a lot of people probably haven't seen the film. So please do. I will keep drumming that point home. So yeah, with that out the way, then, this being a Silver Screen regular flavor episode, we are going to do what I always do, which is to go around and ask for our favorite character, moment, and line from the movie. And because you're the guest, Michael, we're going to come to you first. We're going to do them one at a time. So we'll ask, first of all, who was your favorite character and why?
My favorite character is probably... just for the sheer... I mean, he's not even a big character in it, but there's so many that are near the top here, but I think Wallace is probably my favorite character. He's yeah, just...
I can see that.
He's me, I guess. Sarcastic, but also, like, it's just he's a version of me, and I don't know, I guess I see myself in that character a lot, to an extent. And favorite line.
Oh no, we'll come to the other things.
Yes. Favorite character is Wallace, then. Yeah,
awesome. DK, what about you? Who's your favorite character and why?
I've got two for each of these answers.
Okay,
I'm gonna say Knives, simply because I'm in love with Ellen Wong. She's amazing. but if it's going to be the character from the... I'm going to agree with Whaley. It's definitely Wallace. I just love the guy. He's awesome.
Okay, cool. I don't have two as such, but I almost went with Envy because I'm in love with Brie Larson. But I've dated girls and sort of fallen for girls like that, and believe me, it's not a good time. So in the end, I went with my favorite character as being Ramona. Because, yes, I'm just that basic and kind of fell for the manic pixie dream girl act in the movie, I guess. So yeah. So what was your favorite moment or scene in the movie, Michael?
My favorite scene... Favorite scene is probably the last fight. Is probably with, my favorite scene of the movie. Just in
fight
general.
With Gideon at the Chaos Theater, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's my favorite scene. Just the resolution to everything and people learning, growing, and, you know, all the way up through that fight scene. So,
awesome. Fair enough. And what about you, DK?
Jesus, I've literally got the second fight with Gideon down for my favorite. So, yeah, I'm agreeing with Whaley here again on that. But I will say also one of my favorite moments is the one where Knives is at the door. And Wallace opens it, and he's just stepped out, and you just see him flying
just
through the
left.
Window in the back.
He just left. And he goes back for his coat.
Yeah.
Love it. There's so many moments like that in this film. My favourite moment, and it was from the first time I saw this at the cinema, because I was just wowed by it, is the Amp versus Amp battle versus the Kata Yanagi twins. Because I was loving the movie anyway, but then watching on the biggest screen possible when the kind of electricity patterns form the kind of two dragons and the Yeti creature, and they start having a fight. I was like, this is the best film I have ever seen.
I have a Battle of the Bands poster and a t-shirt with that fight. I'll have to try and get a picture.
Legend. Please do. Cool. So then, yeah, before we get to the conclusion, then we have to give our favorite line of dialogue, if we can pick one, because I will say the first thing I've got written down here is, how do I choose? About 80% of the dialogue is my favorite line. So good luck. Michael, what's your favorite line in the movie?
I was looking up to reminding of all the quotes to see if I could narrow down. I got a top 10, but I guess one that we mentioned earlier, but I still like that, is "he punched the highlights out of her hair" is still that whole scene in general has like about 10 quotes that are great. Like, chicken isn't vegan. Like, just like, it just, there's so many good, the you want to be gone, now you can be gone,
bitch. I love it. Hit him with the de-veganizing rate. And I'd love that kind of, again, subtle kind of dig humor, but the idea of, like, simply put, being vegan just makes you better than everybody else.
Which most vegans don't believe in that, but...
Yeah, but it's funny.
It's just no, it's still funny, but it's,
Giving you vegan psychic powers. What about you, DK? Can you pick a favorite line amongst all these?
Again, I've got two, and one is only simply because it's used in this household pretty much on regular. Anytime, like, me and someone else in this household, we ask if someone wants a sandwich, someone says, no, bread makes you fat. And the other person always feigns and goes, bread makes you fat?
Bread makes you fat?
Yeah. So I have to give a shout out to that one. But I do love... we are Sex Bob Arm, and we are here to watch Scott Pilgrim kick your teeth in.
Yeah.
We are here to sell out and get money and stuff. Yeah. Cool. I already gave you my favorite line, because it was one that slipped by me a few times when I watched the movie, and it is when Scott and Stacey are having the kind of heart-to-heart, their brother-sister moment, and Stacey says, did you mean to see a future with this girl? To which Scott replies, like, jetpacks. Very subtle humor. Although I will say, I've just found in my notes here where the narration happens as well, and I will shout that out. It's actually when Scott's talking about his haircut and how he's like, he obviously hasn't had it done since he got his heart broken by Natalie, and he's trying to feign like, oh, I don't know when it was, and then the narrator chimes in with like, Scott is acutely aware that it is exactly the number of like years, days and minutes that it's been since he had a haircut. So yeah, shout out to that one, just to give us something new that you haven't heard yet from my favorite line. Right, so conclusions and scores out of 5 from everyone then. Again, we'll go around and we'll ask you, Michael, as the guest, if you have a conclusion for us and your score.
I think I've said everything I can on this about how much I love every aspect of this movie and love Edgar Wright, so it's, he can do no wrong in my eyes. I mean, I'm going to give this... I forget our star rankings on this. What is it again?
Out of 5 stars. So
out of 5. Then I'm going to give it a 5.
Fair enough. Awesome. Do you get a conclusion and score, if you please?
Yeah, I love it. To some, it may be a case of style over substance, and some aspects haven't dated as well as I would have liked. For me personally, at the start of this, Scott is the most unlikable character. But honestly... music, comic books, video games, all wrapped up in a genuinely funny package. It's just right in my wheelhouse. Performances are great. It nails the comedy, and Wright's direction is both energetic and beautiful, going from frenetic action to gorgeously framed images. And it's got metric. It made me pick up and fall in love with the original books. So what more praise can you give? And I've also given it 5.
Awesome. Cool. Well, my conclusion is this is one of those movies that transcends the screen to have become almost a way of life for me. From the first time I saw it, I loved it. It felt special, and it's lost none of that sheen. It's my favorite director doing incredible things with camera shots, stylization, effects, and tone. Potentially the best ensemble cast put together in a single film, who all crush their parts, even when they're deliberately heightened and unreal. There are numerous funny moments, cultural references, and just a truly enjoyable experience without really a wasted moment or a thing that I would change. It's a go-to watch when I need cheering up, or I need to chill out, or I need to just chuck something on when I'm hanging out and having a little party with friends, or sometimes just because I haven't seen it for a while. Yes, this film for me is a flawless victory. And I also gave it 5 out of 5. Woo-hoo! Which means it hasn't happened for a while, but by working out the incredibly difficult to tell average, means that Scott Pilgrim comes away with a perfect score of 5 out of 5 from the Silver Screen podcast. So, woo! Thunderous applause. I am chuffed with that. I love this film, as you can probably tell by how much I haven't shut up about it since we started the podcast. Fair enough. And so as we let the continue screen count us out, I just have time to thank our guest, as I said, Michael Whaley, for jumping in very last minute and for just loving this film, because anyone who loves this film is a friend of mine. So yeah, thanks again. And where can the people find you around the internet?
I'm thank you for having me, especially for movies that I love like this. I'm on TikTok as always, Michael Whaley. Instagram is always Michael Whaley. I think on Twitter, I won't call it X, as CM Whaley II, and Facebook is C Michael Whaley.
Awesome, awesome. And do you have any upcoming projects or anything you wanted to shout out? Because I know you have a lot of irons in the fire as regarding.
We're currently crowdfunding for a movie. Wait, it'll probably be, I don't know when this will air, so the crowdfunding may be over by there then. But for a horror film that I'm trying to help a director who's a friend of mine who's going blind. He's technically legally blind right now. He can't drive, but he's losing, I forget what he has, but he's losing his peripheral vision. So this might be the last movie he gets to make as a filmmaker. So I'm producing and shooting it for him. We're going to try to shoot it next month. Trying to get that crowdfunded right now. It's called Don't Bury the Dead. Right. And then have some other, things in the fire working right now, but nothing, still working on my first feature that I'm going to shoot myself, which will probably be a couple years away, but, going to probably do another short film next year and, not sure what yet, but.
Awesome. Well, I can safely say if we just keep an eye on your Facebook page, I often see things popping up on there. So it's the best way to stay attuned and to see, one of the upcoming stars of, you never know the silver screen before we start reviewing his movies here on the podcast.
For sure.
Awesome. And thanks again, DK, for joining me, as always.
No problem.
And again, thanks for your impeccable taste. I have to say, we didn't actually discuss this beforehand, so I wasn't sure how you would respond to this film or if it was one of your favorites. So I'm quite chuffed to find out once again that we are of one mind when it comes to the podcast. And I don't need to ask you where people can find you, because the answer is usually you can't.
No way.
But if you want to find, if you do want to watch, want to reach DK, sorry, for any particular reason, you could always leave a message with me, because me and the socials are available. Me and the podcast, I should say, are available on various socials. And hopefully I will have something up on screen that will show you the various places you can find us. If not, or if you are not watching this on YouTube, there will be a link tree in the episode's description, which you can also follow to find my personal accounts and those of the podcast. And as I said, if you did want to speak to DK and commend his taste in movies, I will always pass on that message.
Yeah, Mike is my call screener.
Essentially, yes, I am basically his secretary. Some would say bitch, but you know. those are all the places you can find us. By the time this episode goes out, it will be November. So if the crowdfunding is still ongoing, I'll leave the link. If not,
I think it's going for another 40 days. So it depends on when in November. But yeah, we can throw it in there. I'll shoot you guys a link.
Might still be on. Cool. We will be back, however, in just 1 week's time, as we head back to the 90s for another cultural touchstone comedy from one of mine and Whaley's favorite directors. Fear not, we are definitely supposed to be here that day. But for now, it is game over. K.O.
You've been listening to the Silver Screen Podcast, hosted by Michael Wilson and DK. Produced and edited by Mike Wilson. Additional material and behind-the-scenes sections by DK. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found via the Linktree page listed in the episode's description. This podcast is part of the Mike's Podcast Network. You can listen to this and our sister podcasts on all good podcast providers by searching for Silver Screen Podcast or Mike's Podcasts. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share far and wide. Thank you for joining us. Come back next time for more movie magic, and hopefully this can be the beginning of a beautiful friendship.